This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement, where we'll delve beneath the skin of three divisions where six teams have picked up their first league wins of the season over the past week, and another five have tasted their first defeat. And the Carabao Cup brought some impressive giant killing, not least of which from Crawley Town, who saw off Premier League Fulham. And on this episode, we'll hear from a midfielder who's a serial winner of promotion from the Sky Bet Championship to the top flight.
If you ask any footballer, you know, the best way to do it is via Wembley, you know, the best stadium in the world.
We'll learn about the EFL's recently launched new equality, diversity and inclusion strategy entitled Together.
This strategy is trying to do a lot and we're trying to really drive it forward. But we just need to realise that we cannot ever just rest on what we still need to do.
And from Skybet League 2, we're joined by a managerial giant.
From a manager's point of view, head coach, player, employee, when you first go in, you're told how big it is, but you don't understand it.
It's the official EFL podcast. Between 2017 and 2019, he achieved promotion from the Sky Bet Championship to the Premier League in three consecutive seasons with three different clubs. It's something Ollie Norwood is hoping to repeat with the last of them. Sheffield United, they currently top the table after his free kick last weekend set them on the way to a win over Blackburn Rovers. Here's the thing I've always wanted to ask a footballer, and I've never got round to Ollie. You know, there was two or three of you round the ball for the taking of that free kick. I can't remember. Did somebody do a step over before you struck it?
No, there was... You're going to ask what we were saying to each other, aren't you?
Well, what you were saying to each other, and also when there's a couple of you round, is it all theatre or do you genuinely...
Yeah, there's a little bit of play acting, there's a little bit of distraction. Because if you think from a goalkeeper's point of view, if there's a left footer who could potentially take it, a right footer who could potentially take it, as I did. But the other thing at the time was on the analysis, we'd looked at the wall always jumps for Blackburn. And it just happens to be that they led somebody down behind it. And it was actually supposed to be Sander was going to hit it underneath the wall. But luckily for us, they led that guy there. And Sander didn't have to shoot. And I got the honour of putting it the other side.
This is really interesting. So you kind of, you had your strategy for a free kick, which you kind of, as you lined up with two or three of you around, you guys kind of had a plan as to what you were going to do, but then you improvised it because you saw something different to the analysis.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And that's obviously, you know, we have analysis probably, I think we have a meeting genuinely every day on set pieces, how other teams do things, you know, little bits of advantages that we can use. And that was definitely one on Saturday because, as you say, the plan was for the wall always jumps. And the plan was for Sander to hit it underneath, but having led somebody there, it would have been pretty silly if he tried that because it would have just hit the lad. So, improvisation, and it worked out well in the end. I think somebody said to me after, it's the first time in since I scored a free kick, I think it was nearly four seasons ago, that we've actually scored from a direct free kick, which is pretty bad. But, yeah, but take it and keep moving forward.
Yeah, I mean, they do say, don't they, with some of those, you know the second it's left your foot. Is it too quick for you to have that kind of impulse? Or
no, I knew the keeper was gambling. I knew he'd go behind his wall because, as I said, I'd been shown that by the lads who do the analysis and the goalkeeper coach. And as soon as I thought I've got it that side, I knew he was beaten. It was just a fact of getting it up above the lads who were in front of me and if I got the right flight, that it would go in.
Yeah, it must be such a sweet feeling, isn't it? When it
it was. It was a sweet feeling when I seen it. The flight of the ball, and you think, that's gone in. Yeah, it was good. It was a nice moment. Set us on our way. And then Illerman comes on, and his second goal was just absolutely incredible. I mean, the way he did it at Fulham last year, and I think the one the other day was even better, so... He's a real special talent, and hopefully we can keep getting him to produce the goods.
I don't want to use the phrase the old master, but only in so much as you've been at the club a few years. I mean, Can you feel the transition that's taking place?
Yeah, you definitely can. You can. The big thing was when Hecky took over and the staff that came in with him. We were in a transitional period, as it was then, as people like to call it. You know, it didn't work out with Slavisa for one reason or another. It just didn't work. Sometimes that happens in football. At one club it does, one club it doesn't. It's the same for managers as players. But we had a really clear, when Hecky took over, we had a real clear direction in how we wanted to play, how we wanted to do things. And we've carried that on into this season. We spoke pre-season. You know, it was, not going to lie, at the end of last season was absolutely devastating. It was tough to take. We just probably just ran out of time. You know, we another 5-10 minutes in the game at Forest, if buts and maybes, would we have won the game? The goalkeeper, the length of a football stud stopped us from going to the final, and then there's the penalty shootout and all that. But we spoke pre-season about we've got to use that as fuel for this season, and you know, there's been no dwelling on it, and we've had a real good, I think the pre-season we had has really set the foundation for the start that we've made, because the principles of pre-season were put in place and how we're going to do things, and everybody's bought into that, and we're going in the right direction.
Yeah, so you went up in the top two with Brighton, then you went up via the playoff final with Fulham, and then you went up automatically with Sheffield United. Now, they do say, don't they, if you can win, the best way of going up is via the playoff final.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Would you? That was my question. Would you?
Yeah.
Yeah, what? That is the moment of your career, is it?
Yeah, the whole day, the whole week, the whole build-up. Your family's there, you know, it's such a special occasion. But, you know, having just been on the other end of it, missing out and not doing it that way, I had to snap your hand off for second all day long, having suffered the semi-final defeat. But, no, I think if you asked any footballer, you know, the best way to do it is via Wembley, you know, the best stadium in the world. Everything that comes with it, the whole build-up, the match, everything, like I say, the whole thing around it, it's definitely the best way to do it. But hopefully this year we won't need to do that. Hopefully we can get in that top two, and hopefully that'll be, we don't need to worry about that. But having experienced it, it is the best way to do it. But I would rather go up top two this year, to be honest.
Yeah, it must be bittersweet for you. On the one hand, you know the joy and the sheer pleasure of the moment, but you don't want the jeopardy or the extra 3 weeks of the season involved on there.
No, exactly. And it's devastating. I mean, I was actually saying, you know, because as you say there, the three promotions I had in a row, I'd known nothing but success. The four out of the last five seasons, we won promotion three times, finished ninth in the Premier League, obviously relegated the second year, then thinking we're going back up straight away. But that devastation of missing out was tough to take. It was a long summer, a lot of reflection, a lot of, you know, what could we have done? And it's just a case of come back, you know, stronger this year, mentally get yourself in a good place. And we're in a good place and we're looking forward to the season ahead. It's early days. We've started well, but we've got to keep going. We've got to keep being consistent, and there's 41 games to go, which is a hell of a long way.
Yeah. I mean, resilience, is it not, is something that I guess you acquire more and more of with experience. I mean, when you've earned promotion for Brighton, but then you miss the cut and end up being loaned back down to the division with Fulham, I guess that's tough to take. And
yeah, it was, but
you learn some lessons about yourself.
You can't sulk about it. You know, we're in the most privileged job in the world, let's be honest. It's every young boy's dream to be a professional footballer. And, you know, you can't sulk about it. You just pick yourself up and go again. I mean, I've always had that inner drive and inner belief that, you know, I'd get the opportunity, and I just needed to find the right home. And I've definitely done that. And especially since coming to Sheffield United, I mean, it's my fifth season here now, and genuinely feels like home and feel part of the furniture. And hopefully there's a few more years left to come here for me and a lot more success.
How does this crop, how does this squad compare to 2019 when you went up?
It's different. It's, you know, we've got a lot more younger players in the squad now, who players on loan from Man City, the likes of James McAtee, Tommy Doyle, Illerman's still a young boy. Rian's still a young boy. Anel's come in this summer. He's a young player. But we've still got the core group. We've still got the core group who were part of that, you know, as we say, the class of 19. Myself, Bashir, John Egan, George Baldock, Billy Sharp, John Fleck. We aren't missing anybody. Alan McBurney came the first year in the Prem, but, you know, he's been here 3 years now. So we've got a group who know each other well. We know each other inside out. We've got a real togetherness, and everybody talks about that in football. But, you know, the new lads coming in are saying how good the dressing room is, how easy they fitted into it, and, you know, how much they're enjoying their time here already, which is good, because, you know, there's nothing worse than going somewhere and not feeling part of it. You want everyone to feel part of it, and everyone's got a part to play. The team that's playing at the minute, I guarantee you, won't be the team that plays 46 games. So everybody's got a part to play. And as you get older, you realise that. And manager's going to change the team. There's different tactics for different weeks and things like that. But I think we've got a group now where, you know, when you're a bit younger and you're a bit chomping at the bit and, you know, you want to play every minute of every game, you do realise it's a squad game, and that's why you have a squad. And especially with the schedule, I mean, I think we play now Friday, Tuesday.
Yeah.
Sunday, Tuesday, Saturday.
Well, listen, I can tell you you're at Luton on Friday night, and then you are at home to Reading next Tuesday. The other, I guess, asset and part of the squad is that stadium and those supporters. I mean, it's just deafening, isn't it, Ollie?
It is, yeah. I mean, it's an intimidating place. And I mean, and I've been on, you know, podcasts and chats before, and people saying like, yeah, but the atmosphere at Bramall Lane. And I think it, for us as players playing for Sheffield United, there's a big, you know, there's a big onus and a big expectancy at times. You know, it's such a big, well-respected, historic football club, and one that demands high standards. And, you know, they've really got behind and got on board when, since Heckey's took the job, I think they've drove us on. I think they've been incredible. I mean, the atmosphere Saturday was, before the game, it's a cauldron. It's intimidating for the opposition, and we play into that as well. I mean, why wouldn't you? You've got to use that. You've got 20, I think it was, was it 29,500 on Saturday there at the game? Was it close to, or not far off? We've got to make it a real fortress this year again, as we did last year. As I say, I think since Heckey took the job, we've lost the playoff semi-final first leg, and Reading at home, I think, was the only two. So we've got to keep that going. And it's a massive plus point playing for this football club when you've got that support behind you, definitely.
So I mentioned Friday night fixture then is Ollie, Sheffield United travelling to Luton. 12:30 on Saturday, Sunderland at home to Norwich. Then in the 3 o'clock, Blackburn against Stoke, Hull against Coventry. Borough still looking for that first win with Ollie's former manager Chris Wilder in charge. You're at home to Swansea. Reading travel to Millwall. It's Watford QPR, and Burnley go to Wigan. Be honest with me. Do you watch a lot of Championship football? Do you forensically try and watch the highlights of everybody? Or do you just take it, you look at a particular team when they're coming up for you?
No, the staff and the analysis, they take care of the next opposition as such, the next game. But I think, you know, if you know, in any job, in any walk of life, if you've got an interest in something, you pay attention to it. You know, you want to probably watch most Championship games that are on TV, knowing that we're going to be playing against them at some point, and thinking, how would we get on against them? What would we do? What would they do? But no, I mean, you have to love football. If you're professional football, you have to love it. And, you know, you've got to throw yourself into it. And, you know, since I was 5-6 years old, I've been obsessed with football, and still am. It's my life. It literally is. And, you know, as you say, you've got to be prepared for the job on hand, and want to give you best opportunity for yourself and for Sheffield United to make sure we can win the games that are coming up.
And you know, obviously Norwich have got going with a couple of wins. West Brom, it took them a few games to get them. Borough not off the mark yet. Is there always going to be that kind of element of unpredictability in football where sometimes you don't know why it's not working for you. It's just your turn to be on the ropes, to use a boxing analogy.
I've been in it long enough now to know that, you know, you're never too high when a win and never too low on a loss, because it can change. You can lose Saturday, you can win Tuesday, win the next Saturday, lose the next Tuesday. And I think that's the amazing thing about the Championship, is there's that many games of football. It's relentless, and genuinely towards the, you know, everybody, there's some that set off like a steam train and you think they're not going to be up there when it matters. There's some that peter along and you think, oh, they've got a chance. And there's some that, as we did, start terribly, but you think they've enough in the squad to have a real push after Christmas, which we did last year. And it's such a fascinating league because, as I say, we're a prime example. We, for 18 games last year, we were 17th, 18th when Heckey took over, ended up finishing 5th. So it is doable. You could have a horrendous start to the season, and there's that much football to be played, and that many games, and that many good players in the league. I think there's never a game you can look at and go, well, that's 3 points. I think every game's competitive, and everybody on any given day can beat anybody. And I think that's why we all love the Championship so much, is that unpredictability about it.
Ollie, I've absolutely loved this chat. I hope you'll come and chat to us again on the official EFL podcast. I've got one trivial question to ask you before we finish. On the club website, every single player has got the flag of their nationality against them, except you. And I wondered whether that was a mistake, in which case I'm duping somebody in from the website.
Or somebody's whether getting told off then, because I never knew about it.
I wasn't sure, because obviously you were born in England and played for the development squads for England, but then subsequently swapped to Northern Ireland through, I'm guessing, grandparents. Yeah. Well, that, some international career, eh? All those years you schlepped over to Belfast to play for Northern Ireland.
50-odd caps and all that, and I don't even get recognised for it.
Unbelievable. Well, we've recognised you today. It was a great chat.
Thank you. Appreciate that, and I'll have a word with somebody.
Keep up the fantastic work.
Thank you for your help. No problem.
The official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Last week, the EFL launched its new equality, diversity and inclusion strategy entitled Together. It aims to ensure that EFL clubs are reflective and representative of the communities in which they serve at all levels within the game. The EFL's head of EDI is David McCardle. And I guess the first thing that I notice here, David, is it's a 5-year plan for change across the board, which I guess kind of underlines that although strides have been made, there is still a huge amount of work to be done.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things that we've been trying to echo is we'll never complete the journey. We'll never get to a point where we feel that we have done enough in equality, inclusion and diversity to allow us to sit back and think that we're complete. I think we always need to be understanding that the journey will never be finished. And all this strategy will allow us to do in 5 years' time is take the next step, which is required of us, because society's changed, people's opinions have changed, what is expected of football in the wider society has changed. So, yes, this strategy is trying to do a lot, and we're trying to really drive it forward, but we just need to realise that we cannot ever just rest on what we still need to do.
So are football shortfallings, are they societal, do you think? Or is there an even worse problem within football?
I think across society, when you look at the statistics in terms of women in leadership positions, when you look at aspects of people from Black, Asian or of mixed heritage of leadership positions, where they sit within society and where the impact they have, it is across society. It's not just a football problem. Now, football is reflected in society and society is reflected through football. So it's always kind of emphasised in this way, because it is the national sport, it has got such a wide range of emotions and people wanting to be involved. So we have to realise that we have that position in society. So we need to make sure that we are really demonstrating the good practice and what can be done to try and make the change that we all want to see.
It kind of begs the question how we compare to other to other countries? Do you look at that kind of stuff and see whether, you know, we're any more inclusive than they are in France, in Germany, in Spain, in Italy?
I think through my previous role and a lot of work within the national associations and with UEFA, I think the UK in general is much further on the journey than some other countries. Now, what we have to be very careful is we're trying to be reflective of the demographics in which we serve. Now, that's different in Germany and France and Eastern European countries. So they have their own challenges and they have their own underrepresentations. But I think in terms of the collective kind of 360 approach that the UK takes within ED&I is much higher and much better than what some of the other countries around Europe. And one of the factors is we acknowledge that we have problems. We acknowledge that we have issues around fan behaviour and around other aspects. We acknowledge we have underrepresentation, which then allows us to see what the journey needs to look like rather than some countries who don't want to address the challenges in which they face.
But this cannot be one size fits all, can it? Because, I mean, if you just look at your 72 clubs, the glorious geographical diversity and makeup of local communities, to have Sunderland in the northeast, to have Gillingham in the southeast, to have Plymouth Argyle in the southwest, to have Carlisle in the northwest, and all shapes, shades, sizes in between, that, I mean, you really do need buy-in from clubs and what to work on custom versions of the overall initiative per individual club.
Yeah, that's exactly why the vision clearly states that it's our clubs are represented and reflective of the demographics in which they serve, because Cardiff is different to Sunderland, Carlisle is different to London. So we can't ask all clubs to be the one. One of the beauties of the EFL is that we're 72 communities, we're 72 individual clubs who represent other vast amounts parts of the country. So we need our clubs to firstly understand what their underrepresentation is. And from that, it allows them to understand, well, what's our priorities? A priority for a club in London, the likes of QPR, will be completely different from the priority of a Sunderland or a Portsmouth or a Cardiff or a Swansea or whoever it may be. Each club's priorities will be different because their community is different. So we're really asking your clubs, one of the main aspects of this is understand what your community is, understand what your club is, and then from that you'll be able to determine where you need to go and make the biggest change. And we at the EFL will support clubs by creating best practice guides, by creating support mechanisms which allow us to do a lot of the groundwork for the clubs. So if they want to go and create an LGBTQ plus fan group, we have created a guide that shows them, well, here's how you go about it from the learnings that we've had from other clubs who've maybe made mistakes along their journey, but allows clubs to maybe start at step five rather than step zero. So that's what the EFL are trying to do as best we can within this strategy, to allow us to understand that need and what's needed. But we, at 72 individual organisations and clubs, it can't be a one-size-fits-all, and football shouldn't be a one-size-fits-all when it comes to ED&I.
Nevertheless, you have got these five, what, central pillars of this five-year initiative that, what, form the sort of backbone of anybody's EDI policy?
Well, that's it. So we have five pillars: support, educate, communicate, embed, and listen. And from that, we have a number of outcomes, and each outcome has a number of tactics of things that we are actually going to undertake and achieve. So what these pillars allow us to do is really emphasise what is important. We need to support our clubs. We need to give them the access to the information they need. We need to educate, and we need to be more aware, more knowledgeable, and more understanding. One of the things that football hasn't done very well is we've never actually told people what we're doing, how we communicate it, whether that's in a good sense or whether that's the things that we need to address, fan behaviour, for instance, which we have been more vocal on. We also need to embed it within our system. So there's no point this being what David Mercado thinks. This needs to be embedded across the EFL, put into our governance, changing our rules and regulations. But also what football has really misunderstood is we need to listen. We need to understand what people want from us in the game. I could go and shoot whatever I think is right based on David Mercado's and my opinion and the opinion of people round about me. But we need to go and speak to organisations, speak to individuals, speak to supporters to find out what is happening in the game, what would make the game better. And that allows us to define that opinion even better than what we all previously have done in the past. So those four or five key pillars allow us to have that 360 approach, that really rounded understanding how we can drive forward. And that sets the path for the next 5 years.
But how will we measure success then if all these communities are different, if different clubs are joining the scale with different communities to service and a different set of parameters? How are you going to get a creative, if you like, as it stands out of that?
So what we've tried to do is we've looked at what we've called 20 key success indicators, 20 things that we're really going to measure ourselves out upon. Now, that is how many collective hours of education we undertake through in the EFL, which we're aiming to do 5,000 over the 5 years, to how the representation of our supporters actually gets closer together, how our staff bases get closer together. Now, that's going to be collective across the EFL. So, yes, we're asking our individual clubs to really cater and really focus on what they're doing, but we bring that information together for us to understand. So how many of our clubs have signed up to the FA's Football Leadership Diversity Code? How can that be a sign of, well, we're doing the right things and we're being challenged on the things that we need to look at? How many clubs have undertaken the code of practice and got gold level, which allows us to understand how much they're actually doing? So we've got these 20 success indicators, which really will be our kind of roadmap of our whether we're green light, amber light or red light on some of these aspects, because it is very difficult in an ED&I landscape to really put numbers on things. Who cares about percentage points? Because we could increase the percentage points of women coming into boardrooms, but if the culture's wrong, then we're not giving them the best opportunity to succeed. So even though we increase percentage points, we need to look deeper about, is the culture right? Is the environment right? Are women going into boardrooms actually having the opportunity to make a difference, or are they just there because people think it's what they need to do? So there's a number of different indicators that we'll look towards.
Okay, well, let's humanize it then. As an experienced EDI person, how do you keep going in the face of these constant displays of bias or discrimination? They might not be wholesale, but there might be isolated incidents. What advice would you give to people who do encounter difficulties with pushing this through and find that parts of their communities, parts of their supporter base, maybe individuals working for clubs, are stubbornly hanging on to outdated ideals?
I think when we have to look at right at the basic of why we all got involved in sport and football. Probably majority of us got involved, went to our first game, played our first game, chose it as a career because we love it. And if we take ourselves back to why we got involved in the game and really think, well, does everybody have that opportunity to love the game? Does everybody have the opportunity to be a focal point in the game, to enjoy it, to love it, to make a career out of it? And we have to say that at this moment in time, not everybody does have that opportunity. And that's certainly what drives me. It drives me forward to think, well, how can I make more people love the game that's given me so much in my life and my career? So we have to think about that. It's not about individuals. It's not about ourselves. It's not about one person. It's all about how can we make the game better for the environment, for the society, and how can we drive that forward? Now, there is people who have got outdated views and who maybe think that things should be done in a certain way and things should be the traditional way of football, but football grows, football develops, football moves on, and we need to ensure that in 5 years' time we're ready to make the next step on this journey. And that journey might be not as big as what we're trying to achieve now. It might be even bigger. We don't really know what's going to come into the future, but we can always just make sure that as the EFL, as 72 clubs, when we get to the point in 2027, when we're talking about what's required of us in the future, we're ready to take that step, and we're ready to take that step together as 72 clubs and as an organisation.
It rather begs the question how much the tribalism of football brings out the worst in people's bigoted views. Or do you think, in fact, that the tribal nature, sometimes a supporter, for example, will clutch at difference in order to criticise? Am I making sense with that question?
Yeah. One of the things I think we all love about football is that factor that we love our team and we want our team to do well and we want to push forward. And there's always going to be challenges around trying to support your team. But when does that support turn into discrimination? When does that support turn to a hate crime? When does that support actually go beyond the fact of wanting your team to win a game and actually criticising individuals because of the colour of their skin, their sexual orientation, where they're from, the language that they speak. So what we need to understand in football is that we never want people to stop supporting their team and have that passion and love and the reason why they travel up and down the country every single week. We want people to understand, well, how does this affect others? And that increased knowledge, awareness and understanding will allow us to be more emotional intelligent to go, well, is this crossing the line? Is this what we would think is banter? It's not really banter. It's actually hurtful. Sometimes it's breaking the law. So we need fans to just be more understanding and everybody to be more understanding of each other and how certain words and how certain actions and phrases can affect people beyond what is the football pitch and go into their everyday life. So I don't think we're ever wanting fans to stop supporting the club, but just support the club in the right way and not in an anti-social behavioural situation, which ultimately most people are good and they maybe sit down in that seat and they think that something kind of, the kind of mindset goes a bit slightly, but we need people to understand that it's not okay in society and it's certainly not okay once you enter a football stadium and sit in one of those seats.
We had Jarnail Singh on last week on the official EFL podcast. His son, Sonny, had just become the first British-born South Asian to be a referee, be in the middle of an EFL match since Jarnail himself. How important are role models to set direction?
It's vital because we need to tell the stories. We need to tell the journeys that people have taken. And that's maybe one thing that in football we've not been very good at. We've not been good at telling the stories of the ED&I journey. We've not been able to tell people how they've came to that journey, what they've went through, how the challenges they faced, how they've overcame them. We've never obviously talked about that aspect of it, which then allows people to have greater understanding of what Sonny's kind of journey was, how the fact that he grew up and his role model would have been his dad and all these type of things. We need to get better at sharing that. And sometimes the strategy that we have in place is a strategy. It's on paper. What's really going to make the difference is what we actually achieve and the stories and the differences that we make. And in some ways, the strategy is only just the very ground level. And stories like Sonny, stories like Ryan Aitken, stories like Rebecca Walsh, the players, the coaches, the managers, the supporters from her game two to kick it out, we need to tell those stories of those aspects so we can show the actual difference that we're trying to make in the real human side of ED&I, not just the bits of paper and people like me speaking about it.
Although in the interests of balance, that's an extra pressure on that individual. You know, Rebecca Welsh or Ryan Aitken just want to make it as referees, but we're asking them to ingest and carry that extra weight of responsibility on their shoulders, are we not? So extra kudos to them.
Oh yeah, and certainly we would never ask somebody to do anything that they're not comfortable with. I think it's very much their story, their journey, theirs to tell. We would never go and ask somebody or tell the story of somebody without their knowledge or without them having the access to it. We've seen that very much in football, that we want to use people as role models, but they also need to have that opportunity to steer that in a way that they want to do. So we have to make sure that the stories are genuine, and the only way they can be genuine is from the people themselves and telling what their experiences are of the game. So you're right, it's vitally important that they're genuine, that they're real life experiences, that we're able to then share that journey, but everybody needs to be involved in that.
So to that end, I mean, what a positive influence the Lionesses Euros victory must be in terms of changing opinion within sport.
Yeah, the Lionesses was a phenomenal story. It's again just seeing people who have really...
I just stop you there? Because a Scotsman's just said that, so I just want to savour the moment for 1 second, please.
Yeah as a Scotsman...
Say that again if you want.
would I much rather that it was the women's Scotland national team who were standing there lifting the trophy. We, yes, 100%, but I think we have to recognise when people have achieved greatness. And certainly the Lionesses' story isn't going to just stop at the borders of England. It's going to flow into Scotland, into Wales, into Northern Ireland, that allows young girls to really inspire to be a footballer. And certainly when I was growing up, it was back in a time where boys played football and girls played other sports. And certainly that's not the case now. And I can see it for myself, talking to former colleagues from the Scottish FA, that they have felt the change of that night and the Lionesses winning the Euros, and hopefully that then inspires future generations to go and try and be what they always should have been able to be.
David, good luck with it. I hope, may your hopes and dreams come true, because there's no doubt about it. The game needs to keep moving, needs to keep updating, needs to keep making itself far more inclusive to anybody that loves football. Good to talk to you, mate.
Thank you very much. Take care.
This is the official EFL podcast.
Steve Evans is at it again, chasing another promotion, this time from Sky Bet League 2, with so far unbeaten Stevenage. Time for an audience with, without question, one of the EFL's most recognisable figures. Which rather begs the question, what people expect when they meet you, Steve?
I think they're very surprised when they meet me, Clem. I think you've been amongst them. I think when they meet me away from the passion of the sidelines, I think they see a guy who was very successful in the commercial world and come into football, and they can see someone who's who's a real professional operator. And perhaps over the years, I think they'll accept it. Sometimes, you know, my ranting and raving on the sideline, which is much more controlled, much better. I think that's led to people having a complete misconception, but you can't do what's there before, can you?
Yeah, I'm gonna eke into that second part of that in a minute. But the fact that you had been successful in business in the commercial world, without giving numbers, does that mean you had a sort of a bit of a financial base in place at the start of your managerial career? Because that then allows you to be authentic, to be yourself, to not have to worry about paying the bills with your managerial salary, Steve.
Yeah, I was very lucky. I was very lucky in the commercial world. I was also very lucky when I bought some property around the London area at the right time before the boom. And so that gave us as a family a base to be able to perhaps follow your dream and your passion a little bit, with the consensus that you might get the chop. So I think when I first went into football full-time, I thought I'd be back in the commercial world within a year or so. And here we are almost 30 years later, I'm still earning a living. So, but all you can do is turn up, work hard, do your best. People say, don't worry about it. If you don't worry about it as well, getting out of this profession, worry about it, care about it, and see what you can achieve.
Yeah, but I meet a lot of young up-and-coming managers who maybe have played lower leagues, who maybe haven't made their money yet, and then dealing with chairman of football clubs can be a very different kettle of fish, because you know you've got that month's mortgage payment to make and you can't take too many chances, or maybe sometimes have to over-listen to some of those owners.
Yeah, I can understand young managers today. It's more difficult. It's probably why you get more influential chairman and directors of football who almost want to pick your players coming in and pick your team. But I think I took the advice many years ago, and I think I've only got it wrong actually once. But I think you pick your employer by your chairman. It's great if they've got a terrific fan base. It's great if they've got good resources. But I think ultimately it's about the character of if it is one man or a board that you work for. I've always happened to just be at football clubs that one man that makes a decision. So from that point of view, your managers today is more testing for sure. And in terms of financially, also the big difference is, Clem, they're probably in their 30s. You know, I'll be 60 this year. Granddad twice over. About to be again. So wow. Very proud of that.
Yeah. Final question on this, Steve. Do you care what people think of you?
Yeah, listen, I think everyone's got feelings, haven't they? Everyone's got feelings. I think it's such a difficult profession to worry about what they think about you, because you're there to beat the opposition. And it doesn't matter what anyone tells you. It's if you support the other team and a manager comes into town and he's hallowing and bellowing at his troops to win, you're never going to like it when they win. So I think my success over the years has not helped me with that. But yeah, I think everyone cares, but the most important thing is that those that have met me then truly like me, I love me, and I've got the best family and supportive family and friends in the world that anyone could have.
Yeah. You mentioned your age and 60 this year. What keeps you going? And have you still got lots of things you would like to achieve in the game? Are you going to do it forever, or are you going to stop at some point?
Well, I'm not going to do it forever, Clem, that's for sure. Listen, I think there's always a burning ambition to win promotions. There's certainly a burning ambition to win promotions and take good people, i.e. your chairman and a football club to heights perhaps they've not experienced. And when I sat down with Phil Watts, it was like sitting down with Tony Stewart. The resemblance, the chat, it was like turning back the clock. And you know, so from that point of view, I don't set a time limit. I think I'll know when I don't have the energy to be first in at the training ground at 6:45 in the morning and last away and not watching 4 or 5 games a week. Still not seeing a lot of the family because you're busy. I think when that burning ambition goes, that would tell you it's time to step away. But I think I'm a long way from that yet.
Yeah. I better just explain for anybody that hasn't worked it out. Phil Wallace is the owner, the chairman of Stevenage. Tony Stewart is the owner, the chairman of Rotherham United. Right. Can we get a definitive number on these promotions, please? Because the obvious sources tell me it's 6, but I think you've told me it's more with some other non-leaguers in there. How many is it?
Yeah, listen, it's all well documented, my promotions. You know, 2 title wins at Stamford, in the, albeit it's non-league, up to Boston, 2 title wins with Boston, 2 promotions with Crawley, 2 promotions with Rotherham. So I think that speaks for itself.
Yeah. No, I wasn't down it for a second. If you recall, I said Steve Evans is chasing another promotion at the start of this, but I can never tie down the actual number, which I'm now going to record in my little black book and know forever.
It's amazing, isn't it? Because it's what you call management appearances. You know, if you record, say, Sam Allardyce, who's a wonderful manager and a friend of mine. But, you know, we can count in the Limerick appearances and it takes them well into the 1,000 and makes them unique. So when it comes to promotions, I don't think Limerick's much different to Stamford in terms of levels. So, and I can tell you something, Clem, winning promotion and winning at Stamford, you know, inside you and how you feel and how you wake up the next day, it's no different to winning promotion at Wembley and going to the Championship. There is, what everyone says, it's no different. And when I speak to someone like Ivan Tony, now Ivan and his family coming, took me and the family out for lunch recently, and it was amazing. He said, scoring in the Premier League is a wonderful feeling. But was it any different to scoring when I was manager at Peterborough or when he scored at Scunthorpe and Lowen or whatever? He said that scoring a goal and winning is the same.
Yeah. I suppose the big difference, obviously, is the higher up you go, the bigger the stage, and you experience that at Leeds United. I mean, just how big a moment was that for you? The roar of Elland Road and being in charge there.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. You know, I think I think it's often been said about Leeds United that from a manager's point of view, head coach, player, employee, when you first go in, you're told how big it is, but you don't understand it. You know, I was 25 minutes in the job and I've got absolute legends of football, English football, Scottish football sitting in front of me. You know, you're Peter Lorimer's sadly no longer with us, God rest him. Eddie Gray, you know, Norman Hunter again, God rest him. You know, absolute legends of the game sitting in your office, telling you how well they want you to do, telling you how big the task is, telling you that they're there for you 24/7. And not only that, I think I got calls from people that I'd never imagined. You know, Jose Mourinho, Arsene Wenger, people like that ringing you within a week and saying, what a job you've got, good luck, and we wish you well, and, you know, you've deserved it. You've had remarkable success at lower levels. But in terms of Leeds United, absolutely fanatical fan base, brilliant supporters, and there was nobody celebrating more than me when we went back right for the home to the Premier League.
Yeah, but it says a lot about you that having had that taste of that higher level and that kind of stage, that your enthusiasm for football still burns so bright that you were prepared to go and regroup and find other opportunities that took you a little bit further back down.
Yeah, I think it's either in your blood or it's not. You know, and I think when you're asked to meet people in this profession, Clem, about an opportunity that they've got, then the least you should do, providing you're not contractually not allowed to, but if you're free, then you should speak to them. And when I first went to meet, actually John Radford and Carla in Radford came down by helicopter to very near my home and wanted to meet me. And I met them, and they know this, without any real thoughts that I was going to say yes. But they were such wonderful visionaries, such wonderful people, going to be supportive. They're absolutely what that football club's all about. And that's what made me go to Mansfield, out of a huge club like Leeds.
Yeah. I wonder how much feeling wanted as well has a significant impact on a manager, because I think, again, it was well documented that Stevenage did want you before you did come in at the back end of last season to save them. I mean, again, that must give, you know, a human being such confidence, that air of you going into an environment that truly wants to embrace you.
Yeah, I think there's many factors. I think when I was, I know that in our chairman, Phil Wallace, is aware that when I was first approached with Phil, I was actually probably 95% certain going to be manager in the Scottish Premier League for the following season. And those talks with my representatives were at a lengthy stage. Now, what was stopping me putting pen to paper was nothing other than grandchildren, location, being away 5-6 nights a week, or probably 14-15 nights in a row, that type of thing, because my family settled where they are. But Mr. Wallace had wanted me before. I went and met him. He was like another John Radford, if you like. He made me feel so wanted, so valued. His mission was a tough one to get EFL survival. And that means a lot. And my relationship with him, I could see that continuing for a long, long time, like it is with Mr. Stewart at Rotherham. You know, we WhatsApp several times a week. He came to my daughter's wedding in the summer and was the most generous man ever with a present. And that tells you that, you know, when you really care for them and the business and the football, then you become friends for a long, long time.
You are misunderstood, Steve. I think I've known you long enough to say this to you. The references to family that you've already made in the time we've just spent together in the course of this interview kind of underpins that, doesn't it? You are nothing like the impression that people have of you.
No, I think it's amazing when people do meet me. I think when hundreds of people, when I meet them, they have a completely transient view. As Massimo Cellino said it, what I thought I was getting was this rough diamond heavyweight coach in the trenches. Yes, I got that, but what I got was a true professional who works damn hard, who's got a fantastic knowledge of football and players, and who will help our football club. And there's another chairman that, whilst I don't speak to Massimo every week, I certainly still have communication with Massimo on things like birthdays and Christmases and things like that. So, and he's a big family man, despite the criticism he got. I only ever seen a loving man with his family.
Now, I'm going to level with the listeners of the Official EFL podcast. We are catching you in the aftermath of a brilliant late win in the Carabao Cup against Peterborough, but we are catching you before the draw for the next round, so we can only reflect the circumstances now as we speak, even if somebody's listening to this afterwards. Steve, the club must be on such a high at the moment, though. After that unbeaten start to the season, I mean, you know, these times in football are rare for mortals.
Well, they are rare, as you know, Clem. I think people always talk about team spirit. They talk about what relationship the manager or head coach has with the dressing room. And it comes from winning games. You know, you only have to watch the elite at our level, the Premier League managers, you know, like Steven Gerrard and Frank Lampard. You know, they don't go off to a wonderful start. They lose a couple of games. And suddenly I hear quotes like, or I read quotes, is the dressing room with them? It's nonsense. But from our point of view, when you win games, you've got a small group. We've made 5 and 6 changes almost every game bar one. And that tells you that our 18, 19-man squad, everyone has a part to play. So we'd like to say we're all focused on an objective of trying to make sure that our club can be in the top half of League Two at the end of the season as a minimum.
Skybet Championship fixtures this coming weekend. Third place Barrow visit Wimbledon. Seventh place Crewe are at Bradford. The leaders, Leighton Orient, are at home to Hartlepool. Northampton against Doncaster is fourth v fifth. Steve, Stevenage, currently second. Travant to Salford. And the bottom two, I know it's early doors, but the bottom two play each other. Rochdale against one of Steve's former teams, Crawley Town. You work so hard, don't you? I feel a little bit for Robbie Stockdale, jettisoned by Rochdale after four consecutive defeats from the start of the season. It's a tough old world down there, is it not? Kevin Betsy as well has had a brilliant win in the Carabao Cup against Premier League Fulham, but just a point on the board so far. It can be tough licks when your noses are in the trough, Steve.
Yeah, I think it's very tough. I would say reasonably experienced manager in the EFL. No one should be losing the game four games into a season clear. I don't think that perhaps the conversations in the summer were right for that to be the case. I think Rochdale were losing by the odd goal and most of them, they've won a game. I just think it's not right. And Kevin Betsy, I think Crawley's been in every game. They've been consistent. They've probably not been able to have a lot better luck that they got last night, but I'm told they were terrific in their performance as well. But it's a tough environment, but you have to go into your training ground every day. You have to make sure you raise everyone. It's not just the players you have to keep right. It's your staff, it's your ground staff, it's all the staff that are in there to support the team ultimately. And you have to keep everyone up and focused and positive, because it's easier to be down. It's easier to be up at the minute. The time to work hard and really be up is when you're not winning. For me now, it's just about keeping all the players and staff on a level and making sure we're focused for a real tough game at Salford on Saturday.
Yeah, at the opposite end of the scale, though, lovely to see somebody like Sam Hoskins on such a high with Northampton. Sam, what a servant for that football club, 7-6 from the start of the season.
He's a wonderful young player, Clem. I actually took him on loan at Rotherham back in the day from Southampton when he was a baby.
Yeah.
And he come, and I'll never forget his mannerisms when his loan was finishing, to say how much he thought he had learned and how much it would benefit him. And Sam's been against my teams many times, and he's always someone that you would have to work on the training ground to combat. Watched him a few times, probably five or six times actually last season. And he was terrific in every game, and a huge reason why Northampton went so close to winning promotion.
Is the top of League Two again, I stress, it's only five games. Any surprises in there for you so far? Anybody surprised you that they're in the... I mean, some giant tussles in prospect, isn't there, you know?
Yeah, I think the two surprises, that if you're a neutral completely, a Barrow,
yeah.
Stevenage.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think anyone is surprised that at Leighton Orient, with the funding that they have from a great owner, and Richie Wellens doing a good job, Martin Ling, I don't think anyone is surprised that the likes of Northampton up there challenging. I think it's going to be a real tough league, but you would certainly say that, you know, Stockport have not got away to the best start, but they did an excellent performance last night against Leicester. But your Stockport, your Leighton Orient, your Bradford's under Mark Hughes, Mansfield with big funding that Nigel's working to. It's going to be really tough to be in that top group this season. But you know what we can do, Clem? We can give 100%. It's not possible to give 110. We can give 100%, and we can make sure that we do everything possible on and off the pitch to try and get into that top group.
Skybet League One fixtures this coming weekend. One of Steve's former teams, Peterborough, currently in second, visit Derby. The leaders, Ipswich, at home to Barnsley. Fifth place, Plymouth Argyle entertain Bolton Wanderers. Portsmouth, who are in third, travel to Port Vale. Sheffield, who are in fifth, are at home to Forest Green Rovers. And Charlton in sixth are at Wickham. I noticed for Ipswich Town, Tyrese John-Jules scored one of their goals at the weekend. He's on loan from Arsenal. Actually, I don't know if you watch a lot of telly, his uncle is Danny John Jules, who's the sergeant in Death in Paradise and was in Red Dwarf back in the day. Anyway, I just wondered the significance of the loan market for the bottom two divisions and how competitive it is trying to build those relationships with the bigger clubs so that they trust you with the young crown jewels coming through.
Yeah, I think it's massively important, relationships from a... And that's sometimes where the difficulty lies for young head coaches if they've suddenly got a job. You know, do they have the relationship all across the Premier League, either with the manager or the heads of recruitment or the loans managers, all the way down to the Championship. But in Leagues 1 and 2, it's you normally see teams that do very well and earn the prizes at the end of the season when they've used the loan market to real good effect. You know, and the young boy, Jules, of course, up from Arsenal, he's a fantastic goal scorer. He moves around, and I'm sure he'll do very well for Ipswich.
Yeah, I noticed that Johnson Clark-Harris at Peterborough as well is firing on all cylinders again, 5 so far. Obviously, when Peterborough were promoted 2 seasons ago, he got 31. I think it's been pretty... I think I'm right in saying Grant McCann's made him captain this season as well, has he not?
Yeah, he has. He's a big character, Jono. You know, I convinced Tony Stewart to pay 6 figures for him when we bought him out of Oldham to Rotherham. And he's probably a big reason, more than he knows, as to why I got the Leeds job. Because at Rotherham, of course, we were in the Championship. We beat Leeds live on television. And Johnson Clark-Harris scored a wonderful, wonderful 30-yarder. And Massimo told me regularly when I met him that when we beat them that night, the fact that we'd beaten them tactically, how we'd done much better than them, we sorted it out. Our system, our power play, probably convinced them after previous recommendations that I could be his next manager.
Do you know what? We should get you on every week as our resident pundit, Steve. I have not warned you what's coming your way in terms of these questions, and you've got a connection and a link to everybody. I mean, finally, I feel a little bit for Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank at the moment at Burton Albion, and he did say, I need to have a look at myself, see whether I'm part of the problem that means that Burton Albion have only picked up a point so far.
You know when you hear a manager saying that, God, not many see it. I've said it, not many see it. And Jimmy says it because he's got the highest and greatest integrity. I think Jimmy probably stalled on his recruitment a little bit, and I'm only watching this from a distance. When he was, I think everyone in the game thought he was going to be at Oakwell and going to Barnsley. And for some reason, either on Jimmy's side, that fell down, and then suddenly they go to work. But he'll turn it around. He's got a brilliant chairman in Ben Robinson, good club. I've got a lot of time for Jimmy. He'll turn that around and win games. But the fact that he's saying I'm considering my position sometimes is done to make the dressing room think, is it the gaffer or is it us or is it all of us? And the fact that Jimmy's saying it, I'm sure he's looking for a reaction. He's not serious about walking away because we don't want him to walk away.
We're going to finish on a sad note, and that is that the former Middlesbrough, Southampton, Bournemouth and England midfielder David Armstrong sadly passed away this week at the age of 67. I mean, listen, Steve, I'm a Borough fan, so he was part of my embryonic football years. 10 seasons at Borough between 71 and 81. But the standout thing is he did not miss a single match in any competition for 358 games. I mean, in the current day and age, can you imagine the superhuman effort it takes to do that, Steve?
Well, it wouldn't happen. It would also be interesting, Clem, as a Borough fan, for you to know how many Man of the Matches he got in that 300 odd appearances, because there would be a huge amount.
Yeah.
You know, any time we've got up and played Middlesbrough and you go walk about in the stadium, you see the man, don't you? Amongst many superheroes for that football club. But I think every year goes by, we lose people that we know, that we love, that we cherish, that I didn't know him at all. But I've looked at the footage over the years, like everyone does, and I'm sure it'll be sadly missed by everyone in Middlesbrough. And of course, condolences and prayers go to his family.
Steve, sincerely, I have absolutely adored this chat. Will you join us later in the season when, fingers crossed, you're still achieving that sort of top half potential finish that you're looking for?
Clem, if we're doing well, tell everyone. If we're doing badly, just forget we exist.
Great to talk to you, Steve.
Cheers, Clem. Thank you.
That is it for this episode. A big thank you to Steve Evans, to David McArdle, and to Ollie Norwood. If you've enjoyed it, please do give us a 5-star rating, press the subscribe button, and share on your socials. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. That's podcast@efl.com. My name's Mark Clement. Join us again soon for another episode of
The Official EFL Podcast.